Hello and welcome back. I'm Steve Murphy, a trust and estates attorney with McGuire Woods LLP. And this is Legacy Planning Once Removed, my podcast on estate planning, trusts, property, taxes, family, legacy, and everything else on my mind. I've gotten some great feedback from listeners and clients about the episodes on one topic, the Spousal Lifetime Access Trust, or SLAT. That's a technique where a spouse sets up a trust for the other spouse and gives that other spouse access, control, and/or flexibility over the trust assets. Those are episodes 11 and 12. And there have been some great follow-up questions about other ways that spouses can use that kind of technique and perhaps have some additional flexibility. So this next episode is on a particular pitfall of some of those approaches. This is an episode on something called the reciprocal trust doctrine. By the way, I give a longer presentation on this. It's on the opportunities and pitfalls of planning by married couples. I love the title. Given that it's about married couples, I call it the better half of estate planning. I mean, that's a great title. That's almost up there with legacy planning once removed. But then a group asked me to come back and give a talk on more advanced techniques here. So I thought of that as the better half of estate planning part two. So I decided to call that the second half of the better half of estate planning. And a colleague thought I should just call it the third quarter of estate planning. Again, great titles, but again, maybe a bridge too far. But back to the reciprocal trust doctrine. So first, let's have a quick reminder on SLATs. The general idea is that with a trust, you can't set up a trust for yourself and expect to have the same tax and asset protection benefits that you would typically have. On this podcast, I like to break down the components of a trust, and I talk about access, flexibility, and control. By access, I mean who is the beneficiary of the trust and who can receive distributions. By control, I mean who is the trustee of the trust or who has other decision-making authority, especially about distributions. And by flexibility, I mean who can decide how to change the trust in the future. So, generally speaking, if you set up a trust and if you have access, flexibility, or control, then the trust won't have the same kinds of estate tax and asset protection benefits that you intend. That is, you might set up a trust and the IRS might say that it's not a completed gift for gift tax purposes, or that the assets are included in your estate for estate tax purposes. Or you might set up a trust and a creditor of yours could still reach those assets. Of course, there are exceptions to all of these statements, and there might be some nuances or flexibility here. And don't worry, those nuances, like self-settled asset protection trusts, are on my growing list for future episodes. But it's still generally true that you can't set up the trust and retain access, control, or flexibility while still having those same estate tax and asset protection benefits. Meanwhile, as we talked about on the episode on SLATs, people like the idea of SLATs because while the donor doesn't retain that access and control or flexibility, the spouse can. And the donor often hopes that they can therefore retain some indirect access, flexibility, and control. And it seems like a great idea. But on that episode on SLATs, I emphasized a lot of the potential pitfalls. SLATs aren't for everyone. I wanted to make sure I talk with the client about what could happen if the donor and spouse get divorced, or the spouse dies, or any number of other things happen. And for a particular case that illustrates some of these issues, that's the case of McKim versus McKim in episode 12 of this podcast. So then clients wonder about this. They say, okay, what if I set up a SLAT for my spouse? And then what if my spouse sets up one for me? Well, that seems like a nifty solution to this problem. That way, each spouse has access, flexibility, and control over some of the assets. But there's a problem, and it's called the reciprocal trust doctrine. Here's how it works, or here's the concern. Under the reciprocal trust doctrine, if parties create trusts that are interrelated and leave the settlors in about the same position they had been if they created trusts for themselves, the IRS could recharacterize the trusts and treat them as if each spouse created the trust for himself or herself. It's actually a well-established doctrine. There's an old Supreme Court case from 1969 called United States versus Grace that discusses this reciprocal trust doctrine. So the reciprocal trust doctrine would probably be triggered if my spouse and I sat down at the same table wink and shake hands, and then each of us sets up a trust for the other, giving the other access, control, and flexibility. The IRS would probably, and probably understandably, look at that and say, Steve, you couldn't do that for yourself. So similarly, you can't have an agreement to do that for your spouse to accomplish what you couldn't do for yourself. The IRS calls this uncrossing the transaction. You know, again, if you do this for the spouse and then they do it for you, then the IRS might treat this as if you did it for yourself and the spouse did it for himself or herself. So imagine all the issues that could arise here. Sometimes the gift can be complete for gift tax purposes, but still be brought back into the donor's estate and trigger estate tax at the donor's death years and years in the future. Or maybe the gift is made, and then years and years later, a savvy creditor argues that they should get to seize assets in the irrevocable trust that the spouse set up for your benefit. So the stakes are really high here. But unfortunately, the application of the reciprocal trust doctrine is really broad. Many people think the reciprocal trust doctrine is only about being a beneficiary. So they think they've solved the problem if the other spouse isn't a beneficiary. But actually, the reciprocal trust doctrine can be much broader than that. There are numerous cases and private letter rulings from the IRS out there on this doctrine, and I go over that in more detail in my presentations. But the takeaway is that the reciprocal trust doctrine could apply if you agree with the spouse to give each other any of this access, flexibility, or control that you couldn't retain for yourself. So, as examples, it could apply if the donor and the donor spouse set up trust naming the other as a beneficiary to receive distributions of some or all of the trust assets. That's the sort of traditional SLAT concept. Or if they name the other as trustee to decide who receives those distributions, and or if they name the other as the holder of one of those powers of appointment to be able to change the trust in the future. So again, these common summaries of the reciprocal trust doctrine primarily focus on the creation of trust for the benefit of the spouse, but it's important to note that the doctrine is not restricted to trusts where the spouses have actual those economic type benefits. In fact, the tax court has applied this doctrine in circumstances where neither spouse was a beneficiary. So another problem with the reciprocal trust doctrine is that it's very fact specific. The case law provides some helpful guideposts here, but there are no clear formulations or rules that make you automatically safe. So how do you avoid it? Or how do you put yourself in a great position to avoid it in the future? Well, you avoid it by working with the right advisors and being very thoughtful and deliberate. You should make sure that all the facts and circumstances confirm that you and your spouse didn't each set up trusts as part of a common transaction. Rather, it should be clear that it's two separate transactions. And here's a procedural note. Remember attorney-client privilege. If you share some of your thoughts in the transaction with others, then if litigation happens, the other parties might be able to get access to those communications. And maybe some of those communications or flowcharts suggest that these are actually meant to be common reciprocal trusts. So this is another reason to be very thoughtful about this process from the very beginning. And remember how communication is going to work. You need to make sure that you have the right attorney and advisors in place, and that everyone understands what the real goal here is. And again, the real goal is that the spouses might end up setting up separate trusts, but as part of two very separate independent transactions. You know, some good facts might be one spouse sets up this kind of trust, then time passes, then circumstances change, their thoughts on their estate planning evolve and develop. Then on a later date, perhaps in response to concerns like changes in tax laws, again, potentially maybe coming in 2025, the second spouse decides to set up that other kind of trust. And there are numerous good facts and bad facts, and those are probably beyond this episode. I try to keep these episodes short. But often an important fact is that the trust should be different. They should give each spouse different rights regarding access, flexibility, and or control. And this would differences, these differences would make sense if the spouses are doing this as part of separate transactions. So one particular bad fact has to do with timing. If the transfers and trusts happen very close in time, then it might start to look like they're part of that one big common reciprocal transaction. And by the way, that issue of timing is going to be the topic of our next episode on a related doctrine called the step transaction doctrine. So that's all we have here on this very brief summary of the reciprocal trust doctrine. Again, Slats might provide some great opportunities for planning between spouses, but we always want to be mindful of those pitfalls. I'm Steve Murphy, and this has been Legacy Planning Once Removed, my podcast on thoughtful estate planning. Thanks for listening.